Hi, my name's Nick Smith, and this is Uncommon.
Uncommon is a production by Neural, a unique digital agency. Neural specializes in content production in the areas that matter most to your content strategy across podcast production, video production, and social media. If you want to increase your conversion or grow your brand trust, head to neural.com to request a callback. That's NEURALE.com.
My name is Jordan Michaelides, and I'm the host of Uncommon, a show that asks the why on business, media, current affairs, and sport. If you like this episode, do leave us a written review on your podcast app, particularly if you're on Apple Podcasts, as it does help the feed work out. If you like this sort of content, find all previous guests, just head to neural.com/uncommon. For the full video, you can search Uncommon Show on YouTube. For social, you can keep up to date with behind the scenes at uncommon_show on Instagram. But with all that being said, let's get into the episode. My guest this week, Nick Smith, founding partner at Hot Glue Agency, which was named 86 in the AFR's 2018 Fast Growing List, amongst many others. I feel like there was a Forbes one in there somewhere, but there was a bunch.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, first of all. Yeah, there was a Financial Times list as well that we made last year, so that was good.
Yeah, we were just chatting about that off air, I guess. But before we get into sort of what's happened amongst COVID, how's the lifestyle in Elwood been during this lockdown?
I'm pretty lucky. I mean, we live in Elwood. We have for 3 or 4 years now, and got a young daughter. She's 3 and a half, and so having her to keep us busy and keep us occupied, and the Bayside suburb of Elwood was a nice place to spend 6 or 7 months of lockdown. So definitely no complaints, from my side. It's been nice. I don't like to talk too much about it because it's a lot of people. We're in worse situations.
It's a very tight triangle like area. I'd never realised. Like I know that I said to you ages ago that we're looking at Elwood and we've come to the realisation that maybe it's not going to be Elwood first. It's probably going to be more like Caulfield North.
Yep.
It's still within proximity. It's 2 km away. Elwood is a very high, probably some of the most expensive land or homes per square metre.
Yeah.
Because you don't get a lot of backyard space, and things like courtyards and backyards are a premium there, I've noticed, because it's such a small, tight area.
I think that there's more higher valued properties in Brighton and Toorak and those kind of places, but I think the way that they divided the blocks 100 years ago, they sort of had smaller blocks in that part of town back then, so you're probably pretty close.
Yeah, and I think we were looking, we just found it fascinating because we found this area. There's this area of North Brighton that for when I grew up in Bentley and then we moved to Brighton was just all land.
Yep.
And it's way behind New Street, sort of next to the highway. There's a bunch of side streets, but then there's a whole bunch of areas that were just nothing. They've all been redeveloped, and they're still really, really cheap per square metre, cheaper than some areas like Bentley, which I found really, really interesting. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's because it's newer, the land size is a little bit less. I don't know, but I found that really quite fascinating. But that is the fun of property, right?
Absolutely, and if you come down to Elwood, we can have a coffee and enjoy the beach.
Now, you were speaking about your daughter before. I know you're a big fan of Instagramming with her, but what's sort of your own earliest memory of your childhood?
My childhood?
Yeah.
So I grew up in Geelong.
Okay.
And from, the day I was born to, even now, my parents are still in the same house that they were, 40-odd years ago. So I went to, kindergarten, primary school, high school and university all within about a 2 km radius of that house. So, my first 20-odd years of life was confined to an area of Geelong that was that was my bubble in the world.
Yeah.
I really loved it. I really enjoyed it. And I think the reason I moved up to Melbourne in my sort of early 20s was, you know, in the digital industry back in sort of early 2000, there wasn't a lot work going on down in Geelong. There was a couple of businesses that were starting up, a few little agencies kind of kicking around in Geelong, but the real opportunity was to come up to Melbourne. So, moved up here when I was about 23 or 24.
Down in Geelong then, like, did your parents do the cliche working at Ford type thing, or were they little business owners? What did they
do? So my dad was a company secretary for a branch of the CSIRO.
Oh, wow.
Down in Geelong. And our house was...
A crow?
No, this is in Belmont. It was the division of Wool Technology, actually. So there was a big sort of campus, if you like, there where they did a lot of research into wool technology. So his, you know, whole adult or most of his adult career was spent there, and so he, you know, started there when he was in his 20s and then retired maybe 7 or 8 years ago now, and they sort of shut that place down around the same time. So he lived and worked within a few hundred metres, of the same place for most of his life. So,
wow.
So he was part of that. And, it was a very confined, I think, in terms of the distance that I sort of ventured from home. Like, it was, you know, home was Belmont in Geelong for a long time. And we still go back there and spend a lot of time there with mum and dad.
It's funny thing about wool, I feel like people... You know, in modern Melbourne today, forget like all these things that sort of really made Melbourne. There was the gold rush, obviously, but wool was such a massive component of it, like really, really big component of Victoria society.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
The breeding of all the, like, I'm one of those guys who just get deep into some bullshit every now and then. And one of those things recently was during the lockdown, I saw like a little docker on Melbourne and... you remember like the Alliance Francaise building on Grey Street in St Kilda? It's like a really stately home.
Okay.
And it's obviously, you know, they can't knock it down or anything. And it was owned by this guy who sort of created the Merino sheep today.
Right.
And so, yeah, I just got deep into all that sort of stuff.
I mean, wool was a commodity, like, and, you know, it's
huge,
sort of still is,
then.
But it was much larger in the... You know, the 60s, 70s and 80s, yeah. I suppose.
This guy was like one of the richest people in the world at the time.
So
it's interesting, all these little things that sort of get lost.
Yeah.
So you studied computer science at Deakin. I'm guessing Deakin in Geelong.
Deakin in Geelong, yeah. Just down the road.
Yeah. Began Ticketmaster as a web dev, and then you seemed to pivot towards digital strategy when you started at Visual Jazz, and you sort of were overseeing a bunch of things, but particularly like Holden, GM Holden, Defence Force Recruiting, and then Starcom, which is where you met your founding partners at for Hot Glue.
Yep.
But there you were sort of digital manager of media strategy, planning and activation, bunch of stuff there.
Yeah, I mean, Starcom, I started there in 2007 and was brought on initially to sort of look after the Holden account, the digital side of the Holden account.
Yeah.
They had just won it maybe 6 months earlier and were looking to sort of bolster their digital capability in the Melbourne office. So I was working on the Holden account at Visual Jazz, which, you know, then became Isobar down the track, and got to know a few of the guys at Starcom because we were working sort of together on the same account, and then got an offer to go across there and sort of jumped at it. Now, you know, I'd spent 7 years at Visual Jazz and loved it. You know, it started there when they were a really small business, only sort of a handful of people, and watched them grow really quickly. And I think when I left, there was 70 or 80 people. Like, it really sort of skyrocketed in a 6 or 7 year period. They sold to Dentsu or sold to, you know, Mitchell's at the time, which became Aegis and then Dentsu, and, you know, the evolution of that. And then they changed names. But they picked up Holden, and I was involved in that business, met the guys at Starcom, and went across to, you know, the dark side of media, as it was called at the time. But it was interesting, you know, like, digital media back then was very much the, you know, you were sort of brought into the room as the guru, as sort of the expert, you know, on digital, and it was kind of that sort of foreign kind of media. And so, you know, I spent a lot of time just educating and trying to convince brands
to do it,
to spend money and to increase their spend and to sort of see the relevance of digital as part of their wider marketing mix. So, you know, that discussion has changed significantly in the sort of 10 to 12 years since I started at Starcom. But it was an interesting time, you know, like a lot of it was, you know, that you'd get a budget for a campaign, you know, launch a new car, whatever, you might have $5, $6, $7 million with a holding at the time. The traditional guys would be, all right, cool, we need 80%, 90% of that for TV, for outdoor, for radio, for, you know, those kind of traditional kind of channels. And whatever's left, you know,
just go
digital guys, off you go and do what you can with a couple of $100,000 or, you know, 5% of the budget. And that was kind of what it was when I started. It was like, you know, 4 or 5% of their total marketing spend was spent in digital. And in the space of, you know, 3 years at Starcom, 2 or 3 years at Starcom, that went from 5% of Holden's spend to 14 or 15% of their spend. Right. And so they, you know, they really kind of embraced it. And I was really proud to be part of that discussion and that journey to sort of get them to really start to invest heavily, not just in media, you know, digital media, but also their digital technology. I mean, they were just getting on board with social at the time. You know, Facebook pages kind of only just came into existence around, what, 2007, 2008, or thereabouts.
Okay, so they were sort of getting in there in the early days, which is fair.
Yeah. Look, they had a good team internally who were keen to push digital. You know, so they had invest as a business. They had seen that there was an opportunity here, and they were investing in staff. And you know, they were getting a lot of, given their GM links as well from the States. They were getting a lot of encouragement from the US because US is probably, you know, maybe a year or two ahead at that stage. So they were getting a lot of encouragement from the US to invest in those kind of channels. And so it was good to be part of that journey and that discussion and help guide them to, you know, to, well, they're no longer in business now. So.
To the promised land.
Yeah.
Do you remember when was the moment when you started to realise that clients' perspective was shifting, when you go on those meetings and the traditional media guys would be like, we need 80%, and they'd just be like, yep, to those moments of pushback and them starting to move that number higher and higher?
Yeah, there was a really distinct moment, and it was probably late 2009, I reckon, and there was a senior marketing, his role was the marketing, sales marketing director at the time at Holden, and he was a really, you know, good, tough marketer, and really, you know, like questioned everything you were doing, whether it's digital or traditional, it didn't matter. He kept you on your toes, right? And from an agency perspective, you sort of want that, because you don't want to just breeze through and just, you know, sell whatever and you know, wipe your hands of it and away you go. You want to be held accountable, right? And he was really good at doing that. And I'd spent a year and a half, like, just pushing uphill to get this guy, to convince this guy about the benefits of digital in all sorts of things, search, you know, display, you know, video, everything that was going on at the time. And I think he might have gone to the States for a, you know, business trip or whatever. And he came back and his whole kind of perception and attitude on digital had sort of shifted in a very short amount of time.
Wow.
And I sort of felt like all the things that I'd been saying for the last 18 months kind of clicked with him. And, you know, whether it was me saying it or whether he'd heard from, you know, people over in the States or, you know, a variety of sources, I don't know. But there was a definite shift, and all of a sudden he was putting the same amount of pressure and, you know, kind of accountability on the traditional guys, if not more, than he was on digital. And it was almost like the digital budget was kind of the safe, like, let's start there. And then, okay, why are we doing that TV show? Why are we using these guys as an outdoor partner? Like, his line of questioning kind of just kind of shifted in the space of a couple of weeks. And I really felt like a sense of accomplishment that he had come on that journey and he was willing to come on that journey as well. So, so that was a good time. And I knew at that point that it's going to be a lot easier to increase our spend in the digital space.
And also that the bet you'd made personally on this space was the right one. It would have reaffirmed that belief.
Yeah,
in some
I mean,
way.
I think I've always kind of been quite bullish on digital.
You would have always had the conviction, but you know, when you have moments like that.
Yeah, when you can sit in a boardroom with, you know, a senior marketer like that who's in control of one of the larger budgets in the country, larger, you know, advertising budgets in the country, and you've seen their sort of transformation sort of before your eyes. That was a good sort of moment to experience. And at that stage, I was like, okay, well, you know, if this guy can be convinced and he can, you know, see where this is going, then I had a bit of faith in what I was saying, but also I knew that same conversation could be had with anyone really in the advertising space. And no matter how staunch they were around, you know, their beliefs on where media was, you know, there's probably a way to make an argument.
There's a really interesting topic that my producer and I went over before when we prepped all your questions, and I've been reading this book recently. It's got such a weird name, but I forgot it. And I just wonder, because I don't come from an industry background in the sense that I've worked for brands in marketing and sales roles. I've never been a creative per se or gone into agency land. That's always been my partner's remit.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was just reading this book, and it's the apart from like the copy book that everyone talks about for getting into advertising, this is the other book that supposedly you read. It's like called Whipple Pinch or Whipple Stink or something like that. Some weird name, but it's really interesting because the recent version, the fifth edited version, is talking about digital. So it must have been published like around the time you were at these agencies.
Yep.
And it talks about the way to go about advertising in the digital world. Like a lot of agencies were just taking the creative teams they had today and then trying to do the same stuff you did in traditional on these digital platforms.
Yep.
And you sort of see that now today. Like we were just looking at some competitor ads in the social space, some of the competitors in that smaller area like ours, and it's all just like, you know, emojis, you know, pushing all like these bulk number of text references and line upon line of information. And this guy was talking about the fact that there will come a time in digital, which is now, I believe, where things have gone from it just being a new thing of people getting in, you know, and all the ads are just like whoever can get an ad for this niche topic will be the best and they'll kill it in this area, to now it's like complete saturation of these digital ads. So we're almost getting to this point now where digital media, digital ads, digital social advertising is the advertising, you know, like traditional now I feel is, unless you're a mass media brand, becoming more and more irrelevant. So I was, you know, he and I were curious, like, what are your thoughts on the challenges in the last, let's say 18, 24 months that you've noticed about standing out more in digital? Has it gotten harder? Has it changed in any way that you felt?
I mean, if you just think purely about the amount of money that's going to social and digital media, then absolutely it's going to be harder to stand out, or it's going to cost more to stand out, right? Because just the influx of dollars, you know.
Has changed, hasn't it?
Has changed, yeah. I mean, like the amount of time spent on these platforms and the amount of engagement on these platforms hadn't changed a whole lot in the last couple of years in comparison to where the dollars have flown, come in. And I think COVID's had a big impact on that, you know, like especially in the last 8 months, you know, we've seen from our own agency's perspective, clients that would have spent, you know, money on traditional media, if budgets have been, you know, either parked or shrunk, then it kind of removes the ability to spend money in traditional media. So you're left with maybe half the budget you started with, but then all of a sudden, rather than spending, you know, 25% of that budget on social and digital, now it's 100% of the budget on social and digital. And so the social and digital budget has actually increased in comparison. So, you know, it doesn't mean that TV and outdoor and other traditional media is not relevant anymore. I think there's absolutely a place for these media, you know, at the right times. But yeah, there's a hell of a lot more competition. The other interesting thing too, which kind of contradicts what I've just said, but, you know, in March and April, we noticed a huge decline in the CPMs that we were getting on, you know, programmatic style media in particular, because, and our inference was that, you know, you've got airlines, you know, companies like Holden, you know, businesses like that, that all of a sudden just took out like all of their spending in those platforms. They just basically turned off.
Yeah, it was existential. They had to.
Yeah, which kind of meant that like, you know, all of a sudden there's this hole in the market where, you know, a percentage of the spend was coming from, all of a sudden just disappears. So, you know, the supply and demand kind of algorithm around programmatic was like, well, there's a hell of a lot more supply than there is demand now. So, you know, the prices kind of dropped pretty significantly in a, you know, fairly short amount of time. And I haven't seen a bigger shift in rates in my time, even back in 2008 when the GFC was happening like that.
Yeah.
There wasn't that sort of shift, and at least it wasn't measurable as it was.
How have you found like the recovery of that CPM since that period?
Yeah, I think the drop happened. There was a bit of uncertainty around the industry for a month or two, sort of late March, April.
Yeah.
And I think since sort of May, June, it's kind of steadily sort of started to come back to life. That's in Australia. I mean, I'm obviously much more focused in Australia than other parts of the world. I'm not sure what's happening in the US. I mean, the election probably had a massive impact on, you know, what's happening in the media space over there. It's definitely, you know, slowly sort of come back. I mean, you're still missing a lot of those big advertisers that in the travel and sort of hospitality space. But
yeah, well, it's interesting what you said before about how, by necessity, there's brands that have pulled their advertising, but then by necessity, there were brands that could still go forward. You know, you think about large brands like your Safeway, Coles,
yep.
Woolies.
Yep.
They still need to spend that money, and they're actually their business is up 150% year on year.
Yeah.
So they've got to do something, because otherwise, you know, next year they lose that budget.
Yeah. That's right. And that's always the sort of weird one.
Isn't it? Don't spend it.
Don't spend it, you don't get it again. I mean, there's always clients that are like that. And a lot, you know, there's always the discussions we have with clients come June or, you know, depending on how they do their calendars, December, where they need to get rid of a bit of money, and so they'll maybe pre-bill it for the following year and go on like that. But, I mean, we were lucky as an agency. A lot of our clients weren't in the travel and hospitality space. We had a lot of clients in the FMCG space.
Yeah.
Couple in the automotive space. Beauty is a big sort of area that we focus on as well. Thankfully,
that would be huge.
Yeah. Thankfully, a lot of those guys didn't retract their spending. They sort of sometimes doubled down on it, you know, and really, really.
Yeah.
Made
well,
it work.
I was looking at that. Those specific areas when, you know, you're looking at the founding of the business, and we've got FMCG, which would have been huge. Automotive would have been slightly down depending on the brand. Retail down. NFP would have been probably the same. But beauty and services would have been massively up.
Yeah. Up in digital and social. You know, like they've pulled back a bit in their traditional spending. And, you know, one of our largest clients is L'Oreal and has been for, you know, a number of years. And we sort of specifically focus on the social, digital and content space for those guys. We're not as involved in the media side of things. They have an agency relationship with another media agency for that. But what's been really interesting is that, you know, where they may have spent money on other traditional forms, it kind of seems to have swung across to social and digital because, you know, everything is now e-com. Everything is home delivered. You know, there's a big push in that sort of space, which is we've, you know, luckily been in a good place to you know, make that happen. So.
Let's talk about the founding of Hot Glue. I've mentioned that word a few times, probably people probably thinking what that is. I found that when we were looking for an agency to look up to, it was probably the agency because there was no one that really took this approach of, okay, we apply strategy, but you've got this combination of both the social creative side and also that production side, which is, you know, your video. Obviously, we do podcasts and stuff like that.
Yep.
And so, you know, it's really interesting coming up with a name. What is the name of that type of agency? Like, you know what I mean? Because there was no other agencies that we really felt modeled that, and it's you know, you speak about it in the bios on every social media platform. It's we're an integrated agency with these key services.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's what it is. That's the thing that we do. And you know, I was just looking back. So obviously you founded with Matt and Lewis. Essentially when you're a co-founder, you're basically married to the person. In this case, two brothers.
Yep.
Why found the business in the first place? Why back yourselves in?
So, yeah, I mean, rewind to 2009 when I was working at Starcom with Lewis. So Lewis was general manager of the MediaVest part of the business. I was the sort of digital manager, digital director of that part of the business. We were working really well together. We worked for 2 or 3 years. We're having a really good working relationship, you know, and felt that this was something that we could probably look at doing ourselves. We were starting to get a bit of, you know, it was an interesting time. Holden was doing quite well in terms of the way that they were working with us as an agency. They were definitely investing more in digital, as I said. And we thought that some of the restrictions that were being sort of enforced on us from the international sort of head office of Starcom, so it's all based out of Publicis in France, you know, there's headcount freezes, there's all sort of stuff like that, which were restricting us from doing an even better job with the clients. And we sort of got a bit frustrated with that. Yeah. And it wasn't anyone's fault in Australia or in the Melbourne office. It was just the reality of being in a multinational, you know, corporation and doing what we were doing. And so we sort of, you know, started to throw around some ideas around, what if we did do this on our own? What if we did jump out and, you know, what would it look like? And would it be a media agency or would it be, you know, a digital agency or a content, you know, whatever? So we spent, you know, probably 6 months just throwing around ideas and sort of just flirting with the idea of leaving. And it wasn't until we got together with Lewis's brother, Matt. And so Matt's background is in the film and TV production space. So. Uh-huh. He had produced Wolf Creek, the movie.
Did he really?
Yeah. So he was in advertising prior to that. So in sort of the late, in the 90s and the early 2000s was involved in ad agencies. Met a couple of people there. One of them was the guy who wrote the script for Wolf Creek. Matt thought, this is great. It's a great idea. It's not going to cost a whole lot to produce this film. I think the budget was like 1.4 mil or something at the time, for an Aussie film. And they went and did it. You know, he went and found the money. He put a bit of his own money into it and went and did it, did Wolf Creek. And that, you know, everyone knows it blew up and they sold the rights at Cannes before it had even, you know, been released on
really?
Screens. So, you know, from pre-day one, they were already well ahead in terms of, you know, financially. And then it went on to do some great things, you know, internationally, and it had a lot of positive, support for the film globally. And so he went on to then make Rogue as well, which is the crocodile, you know, sort of film set up in the Northern Territory with Stephen Curry and a few of those guys. And then he's made a couple other sort of bits and pieces since then. And so he was sort of looking, you know, after those couple of films to get back into some sort of advertising sort of space. And at the time, branded content was kind of the buzzword. Like it was, you know, the brands like Holden were looking at, okay, how can we make more content and how can we partner with TV shows or, you know, how do we do this? And so that kind of really was the essence of like what we thought Hot Glue could be. We actually started the business as a branded content agency. And if you look back on, you know, the release that went out on Mumbrella sort of 10 years ago, it was that there was these two guys from Starcom and another guy that's starting a branded content agency. And in the first 12 months, that was what we wanted to be. And we had all kinds of ideas, like TV show ideas and event ideas. And we had a couple of feature, you know, film ideas that we were sort of working to try and make work, which was totally foreign for me because I've, you know, I had agency experience for most of my career. And we were all kind of just kind of, you know, finding our way through this new brand and content space and trying to make a business out of it. And we got about 12 months in and, I still think the ideas we had are great and still probably are quite relevant today. And if we put them out of the, you know, the drawer, we could probably get something going. But getting something happening that was going to give us any sort of income and allow us to survive was really, really hard. And even though we had great connections in the advertising and brand and, you know, marketing space, it was just really tough to get things moving. So we sort of made a decision about 12 months in to kind of pivot back into what was traditional advertising sort of space, traditional agency space. And, the easier the first few jobs sort of came in were social and digital, you know, jobs. We built a couple of websites here and there, sort of dabbled in that sort of stuff. Like just, doing whatever we could to stay in business, right? And because it was really was that point. We'd put aside money to start the business and to give us a bit of a runway, but it didn't happen. It didn't happen the way we sort of planned. And so that was kind of the how the whole thing kind of started. And it's since we pivoted and then decided on, you know, okay, we're just going to do three things and focus on those things. And it was, you know, social, content and media. Mm. Once we decided that and we were able to shape our, you know, go-to-market offer that made sense, I think, to more advertisers.
Yeah.
It was much easier to have that conversation when you walk into a room. It's like, oh, you do social. Cool. I know what social is. Here's a social brief. You know, like that was kind of made sense. Or, you know, we've got a video we need making. Here's a content brief. People understood that, and it made it a lot easier to get going as a business.
Yeah, and I think any agency, when you're first starting out, that's like the hard part is finding what that USP or key connection point is. I feel like I was speaking to Dan Monheit the other day, and he said to me, when we first started out for years, we did the 5 A's, and I looked up the 5 A's before I messaged him back. I'm like, the 5 A's, what the hell does that mean? And I found this like BCG thing, which is like about audience activation and all that. And I was like, oh yeah, he's a smart marketing guy. Like it would have been that. And he's like, nah, it's just we'll do anything at any price. all these things. And I'm like, yeah, we've been there. Because the first, I would say, year of our agency was that. We did web, bit of SEO stuff and all that. And I soon learned early on that the only way to succeed in web is to only be in web.
Yep.
You can't do all these other things. And probably like yourselves, you also realized that so much of what you were doing was all project-based and the recurring revenue was so important to maintain good people.
Yep.
For when you got those projects, you could have them there.
Yep.
And have it all aligned. And so that's sort of what we worked out is the things like social and media help us build those relationships and nous and understanding of the accounts. And then when those bigger content-related things come along, then you've got the people around you to do it.
Mm.
And having things like this podcast allows us, it gives us sort of like a playground to test things out as well. But that's been hard to learn, I think.
Yeah, and we went through the same
process. Moments.
Yeah, absolutely. You sort of, you know, you question a lot of things, especially in that early sort of 12-month period. You know, we didn't know where it was going to go. And look, if one or two of those ideas had landed, we'd be a very different agency now. We probably wouldn't be an agency. We'd probably, you know, be more about owning, you know, content ideas and you know, in TV shows or films or events and, you know, like kind of running down that path. But, you know, things happen for a reason. And, I mean, we've still got the ambition to get these projects up and going.
Yeah.
And now that we've built an agency with, you know, 27-odd staff, we're getting to the point now where we can actually kind of, you know, kind of own the agency rather than operate the agency and focus on a few of those kind of other projects and try and get some kind of momentum with existing business to support and sometimes even fund it, you know. So,
So you can work more on the agency rather than in it, and it gives you that valuable time to step back and think a bit more.
Yeah, and that's like the operator versus owner kind of discussion.
It's a constant battle.
It's a constant battle, and that's another thing that I think COVID has kind of fast-tracked in our instance anyway.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's been on our agenda to sort of become more like owners and not less operators, but just sort of, you know, put our mind in a time where we can actually, you know, run and create a good business.
Yeah.
Because a good business is only as good as, you know, the staff in it, right? And if they're enabled and empowered to do great work without a lot of interference from the people who own it, that makes a valuable business, and that's a key.
And a scalable one too.
Yeah, scalable.
And it's interesting hearing you even say that at 27, or I think you put on some new stuff during COVID, and I'm thinking in my head like, oh, wow, okay, so it's not just a thing that you battle with when you've got five staff. It's, you know, when you get to like 30 people, it's like it's still always there.
Yeah.
But that is probably part of being an entrepreneur, right? You just get sort of sucked into like, I don't know if you find that, but you sort of get sucked into things and I don't know. It's one of those things of owning a business that just always exists, and I'm always trying to battle with it in my head.
Yeah, I mean, you got to think about what your value proposition is, you know, as a business at all stages. And look, we're only 27 staff; we're not 200 staff, and there's plenty of agencies that get to that get to that level, and you know, that's fantastic that they can do that. I think you've got to understand what your value proposition is, and if clients are coming to you for you, then you need to be in the business. You know, you need to be the one that they talk to, and you know, that's where the value is. We're in that tricky situation now where we're transitioning, not out of the business, but we're, you know, the value isn't just with us, and it's with our, you know, small scale, but it's becoming scalable.
Yeah.
We've got fantastic staff that they are dealing with day to day, much more so than dealing with us day to day.
Yeah. It's the clients who continue to CC you in emails because, you know, they've built that trust with you.
That's right.
Yeah. It's the customer who recommends a new client, you get the referral, and they only want to deal with you in the offset.
Yep.
So I know exactly what you mean. And it would be even harder, like at 30 people, because, you know, also when you get to that stage, you've got staff and their expectations.
Yeah,
as well,
absolutely. And that's been a big focus for us for the last 6 months as well, is like, if we're going to be serious about, you know, scaling this business, we've got to empower and help our staff grow and guide them to grow into their own roles as well, and not sort of, you know, not shield them from the barrage of requests or the problems that an agency might kind of have. Like,
yeah,
we need to be able to, you know, share that load amongst senior leadership team, but, you know, the whole business, to be able to, you know, allow them to grow and to keep them interested. You know, like a big part of running an agency that I constantly, you know, wake up in the middle of the night is like, am I challenging my staff enough?
Yeah.
You know, am I giving them enough rope to, you know, to do great work, and not interfere too much, and let them, you know, let them make mistakes and let them find out, you know, why we were doing things a certain way. And
That's the thing that I feel like, you know, you lose hold of when you're a staff member, having been one myself and now an employer, is how much you don't worry about staff, but you're always thinking about things, whether it's the payroll, or am I challenging this person enough? Are they happy?
Yeah.
I don't want them to leave.
Yeah.
You know, there's all those sort of things, and it's like almost being a parent in a way. It really is.
Yeah.
I'm not a parent, but I assume that's what being a parent is.
Yeah. There's a lot of similarities between, you know, the responsibility that you have as a parent and the responsibility that you have for your staff. And, you know, I think in the early stages when you're employing, you know, 1, 2, 3 people, it's almost more than, because, you know, you've gone from not having any staff or any responsibility to you know, keep food on their table, to all of a sudden, like, you realise that someone's relying on your business
you
to, you know, pay their bills and to keep their, you know, their life going.
You can't just sit that person down and be like, oh, look, we're going to have to let you go. You've been here for 3 months. It's just revenue's not enough for these next 2 months or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, it is, that's the thing, that particularly when I can see what you mean, when you're in our stage, it would be very different, because it's bang, it's all of a sudden.
Mm.
And, you know, we were chatting in the kitchen before about what the go-to-market was and how we've had this sort of you know, thought process internally. We were chatting before, like, some agencies go all outbound, some agencies go only paid and inbound, some only content. I'm curious, from your perspective, how things changed from, you know, the days of 5 staff to today, because it would be very different. Like, I can imagine everything would have been about you guys at the start, and then now it's about how do you create a system that your staff can drive.
Yeah.
So how's that change?
When we were in the office together, it was easy to do that. It was really easy to do that. So, you know, February this year, right, like 8 months ago, having everyone understand the company culture, how we talk about work, how we talk about clients, how we, you know, the work that we do, was much easier to share amongst the group than what it was, you know, post-March, when everyone's kind of off in their own houses. And so we've found that in that period, it's been much more important for us to get things like company policies right. You know, we've set up that's like an intranet type thing using a platform called Notion recently, whereby all the things that, you know, are in my head and in the people that were in the business's head, we actually have to put that stuff down somewhere so that it's visible, and it helps new starters who are coming on board to understand and get up to speed quickly about you know, what we are as an agency. What do we stand for? What are our vision and, you know, mission and values and goals? And, you know, we went 10 years without really having any of that stuff. Like, you know, we had a business plan, obviously, and we had, you know, had some forecasts and whatever, but, you know, it's like when you're running an agency, you just go hell for leather and you just, you know, try and grow as fast as you can and win every bit of business you can. But when it comes to putting on new staff in a working from home environment, like, we found out pretty quickly that you can't just send them a laptop, sign them up with Google, you know, with their email address, and hope for the best. Like, you know, because they just have no exposure to what culture is within the business. And that's not like, you know, the mateship culture. I'm talking about, like, performance culture within the business. Mm. You know, because they're only getting, you know, a handful of video calls a week with their team and their direct team. They're just not seeing the sort of bigger picture of what we are as an agency. So,
yeah, they don't have what's in your head, which is the hard part.
Correct, yeah. And that's been a big shift from being in the office together and everyone knows what's going on. So you win a bit of business in the office, everyone in the office knows, right? And it's, or you have a great presentation, you share it with people in the office, people see you working on it, like, it kind of just happens organically. Working from home, like, it just doesn't happen. if you're not out there actively telling the people in the team about what's going on and sharing those things, you'd never know. Like, just, it's almost like sense of a bit of loss for, like, people that are coming into the industry, especially young people now you know, graduating now and coming into workforces that are going to be, either they've come into workforces that are fully working from home, as we all have for the last 8 months, or they're coming into businesses, you know, maybe next year, whereby there's flexible working arrangements and, you know, they're not going to be getting 5 days a week, 40 hours a week of office time. They might get, you know, 10 or 15 hours a week of office time to connect and collaborate with senior people in the team. Like,
Well, we've literally had that. So from day one, we've always had, like, a handbook.
Yep.
Which is, right, like, everything.
Yep.
Everything from the overview of the business to marketing to sales and client services to creative and production.
Yep.
And it gets updated when everything. So I've got to. The tricky part is reminding myself, okay, this needs to be updated after this conversation. You have to update stuff. So, you know, you can put it in the Slack channel and then it's got to be in the handbook and all that sort of stuff. And then there's reminding people as well. Because, you know, people come to you with decisions and oftentimes they don't. They could just refer back to the handbook, but it's just easy to ask you. And so half the time is also training people to sort of think and look for themselves and do it that way as well. And that's going to be the hardest part with these new ways of working is, because when you're in an office, it's fine because you're like, hey, how do I do this and that? Whereas now it is more of an interruption because it's, you know, you got Slack pinging off all the time. Do you guys use Slack or anything like that?
Yeah, yeah. So we weren't using it pre-COVID and really? It was, the day we decided to I don't know if you remember back in sort of, I think it was like the 16th of March. I remember distinctly the 17th of March was the first day we started working from home, and that was the Tuesday after the Grand Prix weekend.
It was that Friday that everything changed.
Yeah, the Friday of the Grand Prix and the decision there, it was like, okay, this is serious. We went away, you know, came in on the Monday and I had a you know, meeting with the other two founders at 9 o'clock. We sat down and went, right, this is starting to tick off. Like, how do we prepare ourselves for what could eventuate? And, you know, no one knew it was going to be turned into. But so we turned on Slack that Monday. Literally, we you know, got the subscription going. Had an all staffer in the boardroom at, you know, 9:30 after a 30-minute meeting with the other two founders, and said, right, from tomorrow we're working from home. We're using Slack.
Did you get on the Zoom train? Were you already on Zoom then?
We were using, you know, video calls. We just Google through Hangouts. The Google Hangouts and stuff through as part of that package. So that's kind of been our default platform. But, you know, clients use Teams, they use Zoom, they use, I've got something, use Skype, which is like, what are you doing?
Yeah, the people who use Skype they're always like the odd ones, you know, like, oh, you use Skype? Like,
yeah.
But the prominent one is always Zoom. To be honest with you, the only reason we use Zoom is because you can sort of see my setup on the desk there when I was doing interviews. It's the platform for recording remote interviews now.
Yeah.
You know, separate tracks, separate audio tracks.
Yes.
The video quality is probably the best out of all of them.
Yeah.
But Google Hangouts is still pretty good.
You know? It's great. Yeah. If you're not doing, you know, it can do recordings, but it doesn't do this.
They've improved it massively.
Yeah.
That's been probably the interesting thing is how many services got improved.
Yeah.
Due to COVID. Absolutely. Like 3 years worth of
development. Yeah. Just
moved into you know 6 months.
Yeah.
Think about it. Like the last guest we had in was probably April, May, and it's been 4 or 5 months since then. So.
Yep.
Yeah, it's pretty mind-boggling to think about it. So back on the sales thing, so now when someone comes in internally, do you guys as founders ever really handle those initial conversations and sales discussions, or do you try and push that towards your client directors or account managers?
No, absolutely. We're still heavily involved in all aspects of new business, and the three of us kind of divide and conquer based on what the – you know, what sort of style of brief it is, or which client it's come from. So we're absolutely involved in that, you know, heavily. We are having our sort of senior team sort of run the process a bit more. So, you know, in terms of developing the initial strategies and, you know, coming back, we're starting to, you know, lean on our senior team more so for that, which has been great for us and for them. We're still heavily involved in the process, but we're just not the ones doing the present, like creating the presentation and then asking them to drop in their slides here and there. It's like, now it's your responsibility to take the lead on this and, you know, pull in the people that you need to pull in to get this to happen.
Mm.
And we'll be, you know, alongside the whole way to make sure it's, you know, keeping on track. And that's working, you know, pretty well at this stage.
Yeah.
And it's only because we've gotten to the size that we are that we can do that. When we were, you know, less than 20 people, we had to be actively involved. Like we were running the new business process, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's interesting because, you know, we back on your sales sort of, you know, point, we've never really, you know, used trade press to announce business wins. We have very little, you know, in the way of, you know, press or PR out there. And yeah, we probably should do more of that, but
yeah, I've always wondered about that when you see it in Umbrella.
Yeah,
do you think it has impact?
I think it absolutely has impact. I think it's more. I would assume that the audience that's looking at that is majority people in agency land.
Yeah,
competition, and probably not so much as many marketers. You know, client side marketers. I mean, yeah, there's absolutely client side marketers that look at that stuff, but I think
it's like a signal to staff. Prospective staff almost, I reckon.
I think, yeah, that's absolutely a benefit to doing a lot of PR and getting a lot of your name out there is that you become, you know, a destination of choice for employees.
Yeah. Because that's an interesting thing about your agency is you guys have elevated the growth aspect of the agency, but you've never really elevated the new business wins or awards or anything like that. Like, you do have them and you'll see them on Umbrella, but... You know, as an agency, when I was doing my digging around and research, it's not like your focus, which I found really interesting. So obviously, you know, you guys have started to realize that the work sort of really proves itself and you don't need those things.
Yeah, yes. It's a conscious decision not to, you know, sort of spruik that. I think, you know, getting in Fast 100 and, you know, those other types of awards, it's great for us as business owners to know that and to, you know, to feel a sense of kind of accomplishment when it comes to that. But I don't think, well, I know for a fact, like, it's not what, like, clients aren't looking at the Fast 100 list and going, oh, who's the fastest growing digital agency? I'm going to
brief them.
Like, that's not how it works, you know. So why then Big Noto? Like, why make a massive, you know, deal of that? I mean, if you're winning awards for your work, absolutely. Like, you know, and if you're entering a lot of award, you know, submissions for your work, then for sure that can have a positive impact. I think, you know, majority of our growth has happened organically, and it's happened from people that we've worked with that have then moved on to other businesses. You know, we work with someone for a year or two in a marketing capacity. They'll move on to another business in a similar sector or maybe something completely different.
Yeah.
And then that business is looking to, you know, reappoint some agencies. We'll get in on the pitch list at that level, you know, and build up a relationship there. And it's that's purely just, you know, having good relationships with your clients.
Yeah.
And it takes time. It's slow. It's a slow build, but it works.
Yeah, I think Dan mentioned something similar to me like that, is that often happens when you've been in the business for closer to a decade.
Yeah.
You just get these marketing managers that have moved like a job or two and what do they call it, like second order business or something like that. But, yeah, he did mention that's like a key component of it. Now that you guys are at your 30 staff sort of number, what do you see as the key pillars to the business in terms of overall structure? You mentioned before about senior staff members really driving things.
Yep.
Do you see it as like there's always going to be a creative director involved? There's also going to be always a digital or strategy manager involved and account manager and this and that. How do you sort of see those key pillars of your business today?
So we've started to talk about ourselves in terms of a full service agency now, whereas 2 years ago we always sort of stuck to, you know, social content and media. And that worked well for a long time. And we would work alongside creative, you know, small creative shops or other creative agencies. So they would come up with a concept, you know, a campaign concept, and we would basically execute it. We were sort of like the activation agency. So, you know, we'd make the TVC or we'd make the digital content. We'd, you know, execute the social strategy. We'd buy the media, right?
Yeah.
But we've started to invest a lot more in creative talent within the business.
Yeah.
So that just by default is turning us into a more of a full service kind of offering.
Yeah.
And we're finding that is, you know, we do our best work when a client comes to us and says,
do it all.
Yeah, I've got this total budget, just take care of it, right?
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to deal with four agencies. You know, I like working with you guys. I've worked with you on, you know, a project here or there. Here's the total budget, you know, run with it, right?
Yeah. And that's where that integration really, really does help.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, the whole reason about, or the whole name Hot Glue came from Holden used to call, like, Lewis and myself and sort of the Starcom team the glue. Like, it was just, it wasn't, like, it was just a name they kind of gave us because, you know, we found ourselves, you know, pulling in the other agencies into meetings and sort of coordinating the joint agency response back to Holden. And so that's kind of how the name kind of came about. And then when we were coming up with the name for the business, it was like, we can't call ourselves. Sorry?
It's a no-brainer.
Yeah, we can't really call ourselves the glue. It was a bit boring. So we simply just stuck the word hot on the front and then never thought about it again. And it's like, you know, and we still get asked now, like, oh, where's the name come from? And it's like, oh, you know.
No, nothing.
Yeah.
It's not anything in particular.
Yeah.
But that's the nice thing about names, though, is often a good name, a sign of a good name, I find, is when people ask, like, oh, what's the story behind that?
Mm.
And people see or percept that there is a story behind it.
Yeah.
Oftentimes there's not.
No, yeah. But there is. And it's kind of almost come full circle. Like, rather than us now, you know, coordinating two or three agencies together, we are now the agency doing all that in-house. So we're sort of, you know, we've sort of taken on all those elements of digital and social and creative, and starting to take the creative stuff on, and just, you know, presenting as one sort of unified front to a client and you know, minimising the back and forward that clients would have between multiple agencies. And
so when someone then comes to you about a full service piece of work, what are the overarching principles that are guiding you in the way that you suggest, recommend, strategize a certain situation? Are there key questions that you ask at the beginning that then guide that discussion?
Yeah, and it's a really tricky, it's a good question because it's the one, it's a tricky thing to get right. Especially, you know, even as one business, we still have people in the media team, we still have people in the social team and the creative team. And so when a budget comes in, you know, even between those individual teams, they're still like, oh, we need this much for media, this much for creative. And it's like, you know, we're sort of sitting there as the owners of the business going, we're having the same conversations now within our own business that we were having 10 years ago within different agencies.
Uh-huh.
It's just it's all happening internally, and so, there's no politeness anymore. It's like,
so you know. Does someone get veto then, or do you like have a structure that just allows you to allocate that?
That's kind of the dance, right? That's the art of yeah. what we are trying to achieve, and by no means we're perfect at it at all. And I'll be the first one to say that we've got a lot of improving to go in that aspect. But I think being able to have those conversations internally with where we can park egos and we can really kind of come up with a solution that is best suited for our clients and ultimately like their business objective, that's kind of the guiding, that's the North Star. So, it's going to be a challenge, and the bigger we get and the bigger briefs we get and the more clients we work on, that's definitely the thing that we have identified that we need to improve at. Mm. I think we've got some fantastic people within the business, and, it is about media versus creative versus social versus digital, and that's kind of the fun part.
There's every agency's got its USP, and I noticed that with someone like Hard Hat and Dan Monheit, over the years they've become really like obsessively focused on behavioral economics, and behavioral economics is a thing that permeates through the business in memes about processes, design styles, whatever it may be that people know having worked mm-hmm. in the industry.
Yep.
Is there anything like that that you find personally that sort of guided your decision making around things? Has there ever been a book or an idea or principle that sort of guided that at all? Or is it an amalgam of many things?
Yeah, it's not really there's plenty of books written about the topic, but I think in its essence, storytelling is probably the territory that we like to play in, and that's a very broad statement, clearly. But the how we apply storytelling to today's advertising and marketing world is kind of the thing that we like to sort of hang our hat on. And it's interesting. We still do a lot of work with brands who want to drive e-commerce and want to drive just last click sale done, like get me an ROI, yeah. get me a ROAS of X, and we still do a lot of that, but ultimately if we can apply a lens of storytelling to sort of everything that we're doing, we find that is a better way to communicate whatever we're trying to communicate. And that's shifted a lot into even just 5 years, let alone 10 years when we started the business. But that's kind of the where we play, and I think most of the brands we work on come to us with that sort of goal in mind. We do a bit of it. We don't get a lot of performance based media, if you know what I mean. So we don't get the the pure e-com players that will just purely work on a ROAS. It's
very different.
Yeah, it's an element of the strategy, but it's not the strategy.
I think the thing that really drives what you guys do well is that, you're right, that storytelling aspect, because of the content integration, really, really helps. And that type of work is the type of work that can give someone a small ROAS or a ROAS that is just monumental. Things that a standard e-commerce agency probably can't do, because there's no formula to storytelling.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what gives agencies like yours and the Hard Hats of the world, with that creative aspect, the uniqueness about it.
Yeah. It also it doesn't limit us to what platforms we play in.
Yeah.
So if
you do anything.
If in 5 years' time Facebook and Instagram, become a shit show, which some would argue that's kind of the situation at the moment. But let's say that those platforms evolve and change and disappear or morph into something completely different. Storytelling as a concept will still exist. It'll just be done on a different level and a different kind of platform. So it kind of gives us the ability to move with the industry and where the advertising space is going, and not be locked into just being a social media agency or just being a Google Ads certified agency. That gives us the ability to move with the times, and I think that's
if you look at all agencies over the, you know, the course of agencies' history, the best ones are the ones that are able to, you know, adjust and adapt with the changing landscape.
I want to jump into some rapid fire questions to finish things off.
Sure.
I've got to ask, during this whole lockdown period, what sort of your morning and evening routine look like?
Well, with a 3.5-year-old, it can vary from a, you know, a 5 a.m. start to a 7:30 a.m. start, and it usually happens with, you know, her coming into jumping into our bed, she goes to daycare, so we sort of, my wife and I both work from home, so we split our responsibilities between giving her breakfast versus taking her to daycare, and then grab a coffee at the local coffee shop, and then get stuck into it. So it's usually, you know, 8:30, 9 o'clock sort of start at the desk, and it's been, you know, it's been refreshingly nice to have family time where we didn't have family time.
A lot more quality time. I feel like that's a common thread. At night, how have you sort of been decompressing at night?
Yeah, for the first few months, it was like, okay, finish the day with a beer. And so I'd use, you know, I had a different relationship with alcohol and beer.
Yeah.
Than I had previously, because you'd, you know, finish at 5:30, 6 o'clock, and for me to switch off and not look at my phone or, you know, emails or whatever would be like, right, crack a beer, and then now I'm into, you know, home time.
Chilling,
you know, that's kind of changed me, because I realised after a couple months of that, like, I'm drinking a lot more than I kind of ever have.
Yeah.
Not that it became a problem, but I can see how it can be, it could become a problem.
Yeah, it can. It becomes one of those habits.
Yeah, exactly. So I'd realised that I'd kind of formed a habit that I probably wasn't that too proud of. And I think also, you know, when we all went into lockdown, no one knew it was going to be an 8-month journey, right?
So. No, it was a real common thread is like, you know, you see these TikToks of these mums and it's like, you know, 5 p.m. It's like,
yeah,
the wine's out, which ordinarily, you know, they may not have been doing, but, you know, the situation sort of carried it.
Yeah, so. So now that's changed to be, you know, go for a walk or, you know, if the weather's not great, like, you know, just leave the phone upstairs and spend some time in, you know, with the family, so.
Any recommended shows, docos, movies at all that you watched during that period?
I've just finished watching The Queen's Gambit and...
A lot of people have recommended this.
Oh, it's... I think it's the best show of 2020, the best series of 2020. Yeah, it's a masterpiece. Like, it really is. It's not the sort of show that I would have thought I'd get into, but I was completely invested. You know,
wow.
it's an amazing series.
Yeah, I have to check this out. I've seen a lot of people recommend this, and my fiance's parents were going down to the peninsula this week to visit them, and they love a good new series. I've got a feeling that they've probably already watched it already. but they've been recommending some good ones to us recently. Last question for you. If you could have a billboard anywhere in Melbourne at all, where would it be, first of all? So placement or positioning is always key.
Yep.
And then lastly, what would you put on it that's not related to your business?
That's a good question. I mean, for me, the standout billboard, maybe pre-COVID, was the one above Flinders, next to Flinders Street Station.
Yeah,
opposite
it curls around.
Yeah, it kind of looks at Fed Square. The
Young and Jackson one?
Yeah, that's it. The digital one that kind of looks there. What would I put on it? It's not business related. I don't know. I guess I'd just probably... It'd probably be something around... you know, asking people to be nice to each other. that's a pretty kind of, you know, soft thing, I guess, to put on there. But I think, you know, it's, you know, this year's been a crazy year. There's so much more division in every element of our lives than there has been in previous years. And I feel like, you know, whether it's been nice or, you know, maybe just have people kind of take the time to listen to the other side of the argument before kind of charging in, you know, guns blazing. I think some kind of, you know, message around that would be probably where I'd be looking to go, just to try and, you know, take a bit of the heat out of life, society, you know, as it stands.
One place to put that would probably be Twitter. Twitter would be a good place to put that at the moment. Twitter is just a bit of a shit show these days when it comes to going on there. It's just, it's really weird. Someone told me the other day, you know, Twitter is like being at a, or the old meme was Twitter is like being at a cocktail party and everyone's talking about this or that. But now, like, I look at it and it'd be really weird being at this cocktail party because everyone's just shouting at each other from across the room. But, yeah, I do like that one. I tend to agree at the moment. Nick, where can people find you on the interwebs, social media and the like?
So the business website is probably the place to go. Hockloo.com.au is where that is. It's a few years old. We probably need to update it, as every, you know, every busy business will tell you. So that's probably a good place to start. You know, I'm on LinkedIn, which is there's a lot of Nick Smiths on LinkedIn. So maybe just try Nick Smith Hockloo, and you'll probably get a better chance of finding me. So yeah, jump on there. I'm you know, always keen to talk with other people in the industry. You know, people, you know, coming up in the industry as well, like wanting to get advice. I get a lot of requests around for that sort of stuff.
You're right.
So yeah, happy to give people my time. And
well, we'll make sure we link all of that. Yeah, there will be some people that take you up on that.
Sure.
I'm sure. Yeah, thanks for coming in. It's been great to chat about Hockloo.
It's been great to spend some time with someone else in person for the first time in a while.
Like I said, this is the first one since May. I think we calculated it and it's just under 6 months based on the date. So,
yeah
there you go. You're number one.
Great.
Awesome. Thanks for coming in, mate.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening in to this episode. If you like it, do leave us a written review on your podcast app as it helps us continue going on a weekly basis, and we do love reading those reviews as well. If you want the show notes, you can find that below or with our previous guest at neural.com/podcast. That's neural.com/podcast. To watch the full video, search Uncommon Show on YouTube, and to keep up to date with behind the scenes and clips for the show, can find us at uncommon_show on Instagram. But until next time, guys, thank you so much for listening.